Lan stood with his back to her blankets. Here was the one with bared steel in hand. The Arafelan facing him looked surprised.
"You remember the site of the Thousand Lakes, Rhine," Lan said coldly. "Does a woman need protection from your eyes?"
For a moment she thought Rhine was going to draw despite the blade already in Lan's hand, but the older man, Bukama, she heard him called, a much battered graying fellow, though as tall as the others, calmed matters, took the other two a little distance away with talk of some game called Sevens. A strange game it seemed to be, and more than dangerous in the failing daylight. Lan and Rhine sat cross-legged, facing one another, their swords sheathed, then without warning drew, each blade flashing toward the other man's throat, stopping just short of flesh. The older man pointed to Rhine. They sheathed swords, and then did it again. For as long as she watched, that was how it went. Perhaps Rhine had not been so overconfident as he seemed. Waiting inside the blankets, she tried to recall what she had been taught of Malkyr. It had not been a great deal, except as history. Rhine remembered the Thousand Lakes, so he must be Malkyrie too. There had been something about distressed women. Now that she was with them, she might as well stay until she learned what she could. When she came out from behind the blankets, she was ready. "I claim the right of a woman alone," she told them formally. "I travel to Chachin, and I ask the shelter of your swords." She also pressed a fat silver coin into each man's hand. She was not really sure about this ridiculous woman alone business, but silver caught most men's attention. And two more each, paid in Chachin. The reactions were not what she expected. Rhine glared at the coin as he turned it over in his fingers. Lan looked at his without expression and tucked it into his coat pocket with a grunt. She had given them some of her last Tarvalen marks, she realized, but Tarvalen coins could be found anywhere, along with those of every other land. Bukama bowed with his left hand on his knee.
"Honored to serve, my lady," he said. "To Chachin, my life above yours."
His eyes were also blue, and they too would not quite meet hers. She hoped he did not turn out to be a dark friend. Learning anything proved to be difficult. Impossible. First, the men were busy setting up camp, tending the horses, making a larger fire. They did not seem eager to face a new spring night without that. Bukama and Lan barely said a word over a dinner of flat bread and dried meat that she tried not to wolf down. Rhine talked, and was quite charming, really, with a dimple in his cheek when he smiled and a sparkle in his blue eyes, but he gave no opening for her to mention the gates of heaven or Aes Sedai. When she finally inquired why he was going to Chachin, his face turned sad.
"Every man has to die somewhere," he said softly,
and went off to make up his blankets. A very odd answer, worthy of an Aes Sedai. Lan took the first watch as the moon rose above the trees, sitting cross-legged not far from Rhine, and when Bukama doused the fire and rolled himself up in his blankets near Lan, she wove a ward of spirit around each man. Flows of spirit she could hold on to sleeping, and if any of them moved in the night, the ward would wake her without alerting them. It meant waking every time they changed guard, which they did frequently, but there was nothing for it. Her own blankets lay well away from the men, and as she settled her head on her saddle for the third time, Bukama murmured something she could not catch. She heard Lan's reply plainly enough.
"I'd sooner trust an Aes Sedai, Bukama. Go to sleep."
All the anger she had tamped down flared up. The man threw her into an icy pond. He did not apologize. She channeled air and water weaving with a touch of earth. A thick cylinder of water rose from the surface of the pond, stretching up and up in the moonlight, arching over, crashing down on the fool who was so free with his tongue. Splattered, Bukama and Rhine bounded to their feet with oaths, but she continued the torrent for a count of 10 before letting it end. Freed water splashed down across the campsite. She expected to see a sodden, half-frozen man beaten to the ground and ready to learn proper respect. He was dripping wet, a few small fish flopping around his feet. He was standing on his feet, with his sword out.
"Shadow spawn?"
Rhine said in a disbelieving tone, and atop him, Lan said,
"Maybe. I've never heard the like, though. Guard the woman, Rhine. Bukama, take west and circle south. I'll take east and circle north."
"Not shadow spawn," Moiraine snapped, stopping them in their tracks. They stared at her. She wished she could see their expressions better in the moon shadows, but those cloud-shifting shadows aided her, too, cloaking her in mystery. With an effort, she gave her voice every bit of cool Aes Sedai serenity she could muster. "It is unwise to show anything except respect to an Aes Sedai, Master Lan."
"Aes Sedai?" Rhine whispered. Despite the dim light, the awe on his face was clear. Or maybe it was fear.
No one else made a sound, except for Bukama's grumbles as he shifted his bed away from the mud. Rhine spent a long time moving his blankets in silence, giving her small bows whenever she glanced his way. Lan made no attempt to dry off. He started to choose a new spot for his watch, then stopped and sat back where he had been, in the mud and water. She might have thought it a gesture of humility, only he glanced at her, very nearly meeting her eyes this time. If that was humility, kings were the most humble men on earth. She wove her wards around them again, of course. If anything, revealing herself only made it more necessary. She did not go to sleep for quite a while, though. She had a great deal to think about. For one thing, none of the men had asked why she was following them. The man had been on his feet. When she drifted off, she was thinking of Rhine, strangely. A pity if he was afraid of her now. A great pity if he turned out to be a dark friend. He was charming and quite pretty, really. She did not mind a man wanting to see her unclothed, only his telling others about it.
Chapter 20. Breakfast in Manala. "You may call me Lady Alice," the strange little woman told them when she climbed drowsily from her blankets at sunrise, stifling yawns with a fist. Apparently, she was unused to sleeping on the ground. Lan was certain she had been awake every time he took a turn at guard. People breathed differently awake and asleep. Well, women who wore silks seldom encountered hardships or discomfort. He doubted the name as much as he did the great serpent ring she produced, especially after she tucked it back into her belt pouch and said no one must know she was Aes Sedai, not even other sisters. True, Aes Sedai often pretended to be ordinary women and carried it off with those who did not know a sister's face. And true, once he had encountered an Aes Sedai who had not yet attained the ageless look, but one and all they practiced serenity to a fault. Oh, they got angry, but it was a cold anger. He had seen Alice's face in the moonlight when the water stopped, though he had not realized what he was seeing till later. Childish glee at playing a prank, and childish disappointment that it had not worked as she wished. Aes Sedai were many things, and convoluted enough with it to make other women seem simple, but they were never childish. When they had first seen her behind them, outpacing the merchant trains in the shield of their guards, Bukama offered a reason for a woman alone to follow three men. If six swordsmen could not kill a man in daylight, perhaps one woman could in darkness. Bukama had not mentioned Idain, of course. In truth, it plainly could not be that, or he would be dead now. Yet Idain might set a woman to watch him, thinking he would be less on his guard. Only a fool believed women less dangerous than men, but women often seemed to think men fools when it came to women. In the night, despite his earlier misgivings, Bukama had expressed displeasure at Lan's refusal to make proper pledge to her, though his own pledge sufficed to tie them to this Lady Alice, to Chachin. Besides, she had given them money. The woman did not know insult when she offered it. This morning, he grumbled while saddling his black gelding, a horse he claimed was not a patch on Sunlance. That was going some even for Bukama. The black was a fine animal with excellent conformation and a good turn of speed, if untrained as a warhorse yet. "Aes Sedai are not. A decent man follows certain forms," he muttered as he tightened his front saddle girth. "It's a matter of common decency."
Give over, Bukama,
Lan told him quietly. Bukama did not, of course.
It's disrespectful to her, Lan, and shameful on your part. An honorable man protects whoever needs protecting, but children above all, and women above men. Pledge her protection for your own honor.
Lan sighed. Likely Bukama would keep this up the whole way to Chachin. He should understand. If the woman really was Aes Sedai, Lan wanted no more strings binding him to her. Bukama already had tied one, but his own pledge might lead to worse. If she was Aes Sedai, she might be hunting a warder. If. Rhine only waited for the woman to finish brushing out her hair, which she did seated on her saddle on the ground, before offering her a flourishing bow that set his bells chiming.
A beautiful morning, my lady, he murmured,
though no sunrise could compare in beauty with the deep dark pools of your eyes. And then he twitched, his own eyes going wide as he searched to see whether she was offended.
May I saddle your mare, my lady?
As diffident as a scullion in the withdrawing room.
Why, thank you,
she said, smiling. A very warm smile.
A gracious offer, Rhine.
She went with him to saddle her bay, or rather, to flirt, as it seemed. She stood very close while he worked, looking up at him with those big eyes he so admired, and whatever she said, Lan heard answering murmurs about her skin of silky snow, which brought a delighted laugh from her. Lan shook his head. He understood what drew Rhine. The woman's face was beautiful, and however childishly she behaved, the slim body inside that blue silk belonged to no child. But Rhine was right. He had seen a Kyrianin in her skin, more than one, and they had all tried to mesh him in a scheme or two or three. Over one particularly memorable 10 days in the south of Kyrian, he had almost been killed 6 times and nearly married twice. An Aes Sedai, if she really was one, and a Kyrianin? There could be no worse combination. Strangely, she made no complaint about riding on without a bite of breakfast, but when they reached Manala, a considerable village less than an hour along the road, she commanded a halt. And it was a command.
Hot food now will make the day's ride easier, she said firmly,
sitting very straight in her saddle and staring a challenge at them. That was certainly like an Aes Sedai, but then it was like most women.
I wish to reach Chachin as swiftly as possible, and I will not have you falling over from hunger in a foolish attempt to show me how tough you are.
Only Rhine met her gaze directly, with an uneasy smile. The man needed to decide whether he was besotted or afraid.
It was our plan to stop briefly for food, m'lady, Bukama said, lowering his eyes respectfully.
He did not add that they would have eaten there last night, and slept in beds if not for her. Had she followed them to Manala, it would have meant nothing. Following Lan into the forest meant she had some interest in them or their plans. A sprawling collection of stone houses, roofed in red or green tiles, Manala was not far short of being called a town, with above 20 streets crisscrossing a pair of low hills. 3 inns fronted a large green in the hollow between the hills, alongside the road. There, the men of 2 large merchant trains headed east were reluctantly hitching their horses under the watchful eye of the mounted merchants. A train of some 30 or so wagons was already lumbering away to the west, with some of the outriding guards looking over their shoulders instead of keeping watch as they should. The Beltane festivities were underway in Manala. They had not come to the games of skill and strength and speed yet, but newly married men and women were formally dancing the spring pole in the center of the green, feet flashing but bodies rigidly upright as they entwined the 2-span tall pole in long brightly dyed linen ribbons, while older and unmarried adults were dancing in more lively fashion to the music of fiddles and flutes and drums in 6 sizes. Everyone wore their feast day best, the women's pale blouses and wide trousers and the men's bright coats encrusted with elaborate embroidery. They crowded the wide open space, yet they were not the whole population of Manala. A steady trickle flowed up the hills, men and women bound on some errand, and a steady trickle flowed back down, often carrying dishes of food to the long tables set out on the far side. It was a merry sight. Laughing children, their faces smeared with honey often as not, ran and played through it all, some of the older ones occasionally feeding the small Beltane fires at the corners of the green. Lan was not sure how many really believed that leaping those low flames would burn away any bad luck accumulated since the previous Beltane, but he did believe in luck. Both kinds. In the Blight, you lived or died by luck as often as by skill or lack of it. In stark counterpoint to the merriment on the green, beside the road stood six stakes, holding the large heads of Trollocs, wolf-snouted, ram-horned, eagle-beaked, below all two human eyes. They looked no more than 2 or 3 days old, although the weather was still cool enough to retard decay, too cool for flies. These were the reasons each of those dancing men wore a sword, and the women carried long knives at their belts. He smelled no charred wood, though, so it had been a small raid and unsuccessful. Lady Alice stopped her mare beside the stakes and stared at them. Not in amazement or fear or disgust. Her face was a perfect mask of calm. For an instant, he could almost believe she truly was Aes Sedai. "I should have hated to face these creatures armed with only a sword," she murmured. "I cannot imagine the courage needed to do that."
"You have faced Trollocs?"
Lan asked in surprise. Rhyne and Bukama exchanged startled looks.
"Yes."
She grimaced faintly, as if the word had slipped out before thought.
"Where, if I may ask?" he said.
Few southerners had ever seen a Trolloc. Some called them tales to frighten children. Alice eyed him coolly, very coolly.
"Shadowspawn can be found in places you never dream of, Master Lan. Choose us an inn, Rhyne," she added with a smile.
The woman actually believed she was in charge. From the way Rhyne jumped to obey, so did he. The Plowman's Blade was 2 stories of red-roofed stone with arrow slits rather than windows on the ground floor, and a two-handed sword of the sort farmers carried on their plows hanging point down above a door of heavy planks. This near the Blight, inns served as strong points against a Trolloc attack, and so did many houses. The innkeeper, a stout graying woman, her billowing blouse worked with red and yellow flowers and her wide trousers covered in red and blue, came from the green when she saw them tying their horses to the hitching rings set in front of the inn. Mistress Tomichi looked uneasy about 2 Malkieri stopping at her inn, but she brightened when Alice began issuing commands for her breakfast.
"As you say, my lady," the round-faced innkeeper murmured, giving Alice a deep curtsy.
The Kyrianen had given no name, but her manner and dress did suggest a lady.
"And will you want rooms for yourself and your retainers?"
"Thank you, no," Alice replied. "I intend to ride on soon."
Rhyne showed no offense at being called a retainer, accepting the word as easily as Alice did. But Bukama's perpetual scowl darkened. He said nothing, of course, not here, and perhaps would not ever, given his pledge. Lan decided he would have a few quiet words with Alice when he had the chance. There was a limit to how many insults a man could swallow in silence. He and the other men ordered dark bread and strong tea and bowls of porridge with slivers of ham in it. Alice did not invite them to share her table in the large common room, so they took benches at another. There were plenty to choose from, given that they were alone except for Mistress Tomichi, who served them with her own hands, explaining that she did not want to pull anyone from the festivities. Indeed, once she had taken payment, she returned to them herself. Taking advantage of their privacy, Lan and the others discussed the diminutive woman who had attached herself to them. Or rather, they argued about her, in low voices so as not to be overheard. Utterly convinced that Alice was Aes Sedai, Rhyne recommended asking no questions. Questions could be dangerous with Aes Sedai, and you might not like the answers. Bukama maintained that they needed to know what she wanted with them, especially if she were Aes Sedai. Tangling in some unknown Aes Sedai scheme could be hazardous. A man could acquire enemies without knowing it, or be sacrificed without warning to further her plans. Lan forbore mentioning that it was Bukama who had placed their feet in that snare. He himself just could not believe she was a sister. He thought her a wilder placed to watch him by Idaine, though he did not mention her name, of course. Idaine likely had eyes and ears the breadth of the borderlands. It did seem an unlikely coincidence that she would happen to have a wilder waiting for him in Canluum, but there had been those 6 men, and he could not think of anyone else who might have sent them.
"I still say,"
Bukama began, then bit off an oath.
Where did she go?
Alice's bowl sat empty on the table where she had been sitting, but there was no sign of the woman herself. Lan's eyebrows rose in admiration in spite of himself. He had not heard a sound of her leaving. Scraping his bench back noisily, Ryan rushed to one of the arrow slits and peered out.
Her horse is still there. Maybe she's just visiting the privy.
Lan winced inwardly at the crudity. There were matters one spoke of and matters one did not. Ryan fingered one of his braids, then gave it a hard tug that made its bells jingle.
I say we leave her silver and go before she comes back.
Go if you wish, Lan said, rising. Bukama pledged to her, and I'll honor his pledge. Better if you honor your own, Bukama grumbled.
Ryan grimaced and gave his braid another hard pull.
If you stay, I stay.
Perhaps the woman had just gone out for a glimpse of the festivities. Telling Bukama to remain in case she returned, Lan took Ryan out to see. She was nowhere among the dancers or the onlookers, though. In her silks, she would have stood out among all that embroidered linen and wool. Some of the women asked them to dance, and Ryan smiled at the prettier ones. The man would stop to smile at a pretty face if a dozen trollocs were charging him, but Lan sent him off to look among the houses on the southern hill while he climbed the one behind the plowman's blade. He did not want Alice meeting someone behind his back, perhaps arranging some surprise for later in the day. Just because the woman had not tried to kill him did not mean Edain wanted him alive. He found her in a nearly empty street halfway up the hill, receiving the curtsy of a lean young woman whose blouse and wide trousers were embroidered in red and gold patterns, as intricate as those on Alice's riding dress. Kandori were as bad as Southerners when it came to embroidery. Stepping softly, he closed to listening distance of Alice's back and stopped.
There's some Saharas live three streets that way, my lady, the lean woman said with a gesture. And I think there's some live on South Hill, but I don't know if any are named Avina.
You have been a great help, Mistress Marishna, Alice said warmly. Thank you.
Accepting another curtsy, she stood watching the other woman walk on uphill. Once Mistress Marishna was beyond earshot, she spoke again, and her voice was anything but warm.
Shall I show you how eavesdropping is punished in the White Tower, Master Lan?
He very nearly blinked. First she managed to leave the common without him hearing, and now she heard him when he was trying to be quiet. Remarkable. Perhaps she was Aes Sedai, which meant she might be looking at Ryan for a warder.
I think not, he told the back of her head. We have business in Chachin that cannot wait. Perhaps your search will go more quickly if we help you find this Avina Sahara.
She turned very quickly and peered up at him, straining for height. He thought she might be up on her toes.
No, she was no Aes Sedai, despite the icy look of command on her face. He had seen shorter Aes Sedai dominate rooms full of men who had no idea who they were, and without any straining.
Better for you to forget hearing that name, she said coldly. It is unwise to meddle in the affairs of Aes Sedai. You may leave me now, but I expect to find you ready to go on when I am done. If, that is, Malkyrie keep their word as I have been told they do.
With that insult, she stalked off in the direction the lean woman had pointed. Like the woman had a tongue like a knife. When he returned to the plowman's blade and told Bukama what he had learned, the elder man brightened. Well, his scowl lessened a little. For him, that was as good as a grin from anyone else.
Maybe all she wants from us is protection until she finds this woman. That doesn't explain why she followed us for a whole day, Lan said, dropping onto the bench in front of his breakfast bowl. He might as well finish the porridge. And don't suggest she was afraid to approach us. I think that woman frightens as easily as you do.
Bukama had no answer for that. Chapter 21 Some Tricks of the Power. Lan knew the ride to Chachin would be one he would rather forget, and the journey met his expectations. They rode hard, passing merchants' trains of wagons, never stopping long in a village and sleeping under the stars most nights, since no one had the coin for inns, not for four people with horses. Barns and haylofts had to do, when there was a barn or hayloft to be found come nightfall.
Many of the hills along the road bore neither village nor farm, only towering oak and leatherleaf, pine and fir, with smaller beech and sour gum scattered through. In the borderlands, there were no such things as isolated farms. Sooner or later, a farm set off by itself became a graveyard. Alice continued her search for the Sahara woman in every village they passed, though she fell silent whenever Lan or one of the others approached, and eyed them frostily until they went away. The woman had a ready way with a frosty eye. For him, anyway. Rhine twitched and peered wide-eyed at her, fetched and trotted and offered up compliments like a courtier on a leash, still bouncing between enraptured and fearful, and she accepted his subservience and his praise alike as her due, while laughing at his witticisms. Not that she focused only on him. She seldom let an hour go by without probing questions directed at each of them in turn, till it seemed she wanted to know the entire story of their lives. The woman was like a swarm of black flies. No matter how many you swatted, there were always more to bite. Even Rhine knew enough to deflect that sort of interrogation. A man's past belonged to himself and the people who had lived it with him. It was not a matter for gossip with an inquisitive woman. Despite her questions, Bukama continued his carping. Day and night, it seemed, every second comment out of his mouth regarded the pledge. Lan began to think the only way to silence the man would be to take oath not to give her the pledge. Twice, thick black clouds rolled down out of the blight to unleash driving downpours of freezing rain mixed with hail large enough to crack a man's head. The worst storms in spring came from the blight. When the first of those clouds darkened the sky to the north, he began looking for a place where the tree's branches might be thick enough to afford some shelter, maybe with the aid of blankets stretched overhead. But when Alice realized what he was doing, she said coolly, "There is no need to stop, Master Lan. You are under my protection." Doubtful of that, he was still looking when the storm struck. Lightning flashed in blue-white streaks across a sky that seemed suddenly night, and thunder crashed like monstrous kettle drums overhead. But the driving rain sheeted down an invisible dome that moved with their horses, and the hailstones bounced off it in an eerie silence, as though they had struck nothing at all. She performed the same service for the second storm, and both times she seemed surprised at their offered thanks. Her face hardly altered in its smoothness, a very good imitation of an Aes Sedai's serene expression, but something flickered above her eyes. A strange woman. They saw bandits, as rumored, usually a pack of 10 or 12 roughly dressed men, who counted the odds against 3 with arrows knocked and melted back into the trees before Lan and the rest reached them. He or Bukama always went after them, just far enough to make sure they really had gone, while the other two guarded Alice. It would have been foolish to ride into an ambush they knew might be waiting. Noon on the fourth day found them riding through the forested hills along a road that stretched empty as far as the eye could see in either direction. The sky was clear, with just a few scattered white clouds drifting high up, and the only sounds were their horses' hooves and squirrels chittering on branches. Suddenly, horsemen burst from the trees on both sides of the road, some 30 paces ahead, 20 or so scruffy fellows who formed a line blocking the way, and the pounding of hooves told of more behind. Dropping his reins in the pommel of his saddle, Lan snatched 2 more arrows and held them between his fingers as he drew the one already knocked. He doubted he would have time for even a second shot, but there was always a chance. 3 of the men in front of him wore much battered breastplates stained with rust over their dirty coats, and one had a rust-spotted helmet with a barred face guard. None carried a bow, not that that made any great difference.
23 behind at 30 paces, Bukama called. No bows. On your word.
No difference at all against a band large enough to attack most merchant trains. He did not loose, however. So long as the men only sat their horses, a chance remained. A small one. Life and death often turned on small chances.
"Let's not be too hasty," the helmeted man called, removing it to reveal a grizzled head of greasy hair and a narrow, dirty face that had last been touched by a razor a week gone. His wide smile showed 2 missing teeth.
"You might be able to kill 2 or 3 of us before we cut you down, but there's no need for that. Let us have your coin and the pretty lady's jewelry, and you can go on your way. Pretty ladies in silk and fur always have lots of jewels, eh?"
He leered past Lan at Alice. Maybe he thought it a friendly smile. There was no temptation in the offer. These fellows wanted no casualties among themselves if they could manage it so, but surrender meant that he and Bukama and Ryan would have their throats slit. They probably intended to keep Alice alive until they decided she was a danger. If she had some trick of the power up her sleeve, he wished she would...
"You dare impede the way of an Aes Sedai?"
she thundered, and it was thunder, setting some of the brigands' horses snorting and plunging. Cat Dancer, knowing what dropped reins meant, remained still beneath him, awaiting the pressures of knee and heel.
"Surrender, or face my wrath!"
And red fire exploded with a roar above the bandits' heads, sending more of their mounts into panicked bucking that tumbled two of the poorer riders to the road.
"I told you she was Aes Sedai, Coy,"
whined a fat, balding fellow in a breastplate that was too small for him.
"Didn't I say that, Coy? A green with her three warders, I said."
The lean man backhanded him across the face without taking his eyes from Lan, or more likely from Alice behind him.
"No talk of surrender now. There's still 50 of us and 4 of you. Rather than face the noose, we'll take our chances on how many you can kill before we take you."
"Well and good," Lan said. "But if I can see one of you at count of 10, it begins."
With the last word, he started counting in a loud voice. The bandits did not let him reach 2 before they were galloping back toward the trees. By 4, the dismounted pair stopped trying to gain the saddles of their wild-eyed animals and took off afoot as fast as they could go. There was no need to follow. The pounding and crackle of horses being galloped through brush rather than around it was fast fading into the distance. In the circumstances, it was the best end that could be hoped for. Except that Alice did not see it so.
"You had no right to let them go," she said indignantly,
anger flashing in her eyes as she did her best to skewer each of them with her gaze. She reined her mare around to make certain they each received a dose.
"Had they attacked, I could have used the one power against them. How many people have they robbed and murdered? How many women ravished? How many children orphaned? We should have fought them and taken the survivors to the nearest magistrate."
Lan, Bukama, and Ryan took turns trying to convince her how unlikely it was that any of the 4 of them would have been among the survivors. The bandits would have fought hard to avoid the gallows, and sheer numbers did count. But she actually seemed to believe she could have defeated close on 50 men by herself. A very strange woman. Had it been only storms and bandits, that would have been more than he expected on any journey. Ryan's foolishness and Bukama's complaints could have been taken as a matter of course, too. But Alice was blind about a great deal, and that made all the difference. That first night, he had sat in the wet to let her know he would accept what she had done. If they were to travel together, better to end it with honors even, as she must see it. Except that she did not. The second night, she remained awake till dawn and made sure he did as well, with sharp flicks of an invisible switch whenever he nodded off. The third night, sand somehow got inside his clothes and boots, a thick coating of it. He had shaken out what he could and, without water to wash, rode covered in grit the next day. The night after the bandits, he could not understand how she managed to make ants crawl into his small clothes and make them all bite at once. It had been her doing for sure. She was standing over him when his eyes shot open, and she appeared surprised that he did not cry out. Clearly she wanted some response, some reaction, but he could not see what. If she felt that she had not been repaid for her wetting, then she was a very hard woman. But a woman could set the price for her insult or injury, and there were no other women here to call an end when she went beyond what they considered just. All he could do was endure until they reached Chachin. The following night she discovered a patch of blister leaf near their campsite, and to his shame, he almost lost his temper. He did not mention the incidents to Bukama or Ryan, of course, though he was certain they knew. But he began to pray for Chachin to loom up ahead at the next rise. Perhaps Edain had set the woman to watch him, but it was beginning to seem she meant to kill him after all. Slowly.
Moiraine could not understand the stubbornness of this Lan Mandragoran, though Swan said that stubborn was a redundancy when it came to men. All she wanted was a display of remorse for dunking her. Well, that and an apology. An abject apology, and a proper regard for an Aes Sedai. But he never displayed the slightest scrap of penitence. He was frozen arrogance to the core, His disbelief of her right to the shawl was so plain, he might as well have spoken aloud. A part of her admired his fortitude, but only a part. She would bring him properly to heel. Not to tame him utterly. A completely tame man was no use to himself or anyone else. But to make certain he recognized his mistakes right down to his bones. She allowed him his days to reflect while she planned what she would do to him that night. The ants had been a great disappointment. That was one of the Blue Aja secrets, a way to repel insects or make them gather and bite or sting, though not intended for the use she had put it to. But she was quite proud of the blister leaf, which at least made him jump a bit, proving that he really was made of human flesh. She had begun to doubt that. Oddly, neither of the other men ever offered him a word of commiseration that she heard, though they had to know what she was doing. If he voiced no complaints to her, which was peculiar enough in itself, surely he did to his friends. That was one thing friends were for. But the three were strangely reticent in other ways, too. Even in Kyrian, people would talk about themselves, a little, and she had been taught that Borderlanders shunned the game of houses, yet they revealed almost nothing about themselves, even after she primed their tongues with incidents from her own youth in Kyrian and from the tower. Ryan at least laughed when the story was funny. Once he realized he was supposed to laugh, he did. But Lan and Bukama actually looked embarrassed. She thought that was the emotion they displayed. They could have taught Aes Sedai to control their faces. They admitted having met sisters before her, but when she probed ever so delicately to learn where and when.
"There are Aes Sedai so many places that they are difficult to recall," Lan replied one evening as they rode ahead of their own long shadows. "We'd best stop at those farmhouses ahead and see whether we can hire the use of a hayloft for the night. We won't see another house till well after full dark."
That was typical. Those three could have taught Aes Sedai about oblique answers and deflecting questions, too. Worst of all, she still had no idea whether any of them were dark friends. Of course she had no real reason to think that any of the sisters in Canluum had been Black Aja, and if they were not, Rhine's visit to the Gates of Heaven likely had had some purely innocent purpose, yet wariness made her continue her questions. She still laid a ward around each of them every night. She could not afford to trust anyone except Swan until she was sure of them. Other Aes Sedai and any men who might be involved with them least of all. 2 days from Chachin, in a village called Ravinda, she finally located Avin Sahira, the very first woman she spoke to in the place. Ravinda was a thriving village, though much smaller than Manala, with a wide field of hard-packed dirt that served as a market for folk from neighboring villages to barter produce and handcrafts and buy from peddlers. 2 peddlers' wagons, their tall canvas covers festooned with pots and pans, stood surrounded by crowds when she and her reticent companions arrived that morning, each peddler glaring at his competitor despite the people clamoring for his own goods. Ravinda also had an inn under construction, the second floor already building, the result of Mistress Sahira receiving the bounty. She intended to call it the White Tower.
"You think the sisters might object?" she said, frowning at the sign already carved and painted and hung above the front door, when Warain suggested a change in the name. By the scale, the tower on the sign would have had to be over 1,000 feet high. Avin was a plump, graying woman with a silver-mounted, foot-long dagger hanging at her worked leather belt and yellow embroidery covering the sleeves of her bright red blouse. Apparently the bounty had put a touch of feast day into every day for her. Finally she shook her head.
"I can't see why they would, my lady. The Aes Sedai who took names in our camp was very soft-spoken and pleasant."
The woman would learn, the first time a sister who cared to reveal herself happened by. Moiraine wished she remembered which accepted had taken Avin Sahira's name and had a chance to give the child a piece of her mind. Avin's son, Miguel, her 10th child, had been born 30 miles from Dragonmount and a week before Gitara spoke her foretelling. That sort of carelessness in writing down what you heard was intolerable.
How many more names in her book would turn out to have borne children outside the specified 10 days? Riding away from Ravinda, the men's obvious delight that she had been quick turned her smoldering irritation from the unknown accepted to them. Oh, they did not show it openly, but she heard Rhine say it. At least she was fast with it this time, not quite prudent enough about being overheard, and Bukama muttered a sour agreement as they fell in behind her. Lan was riding ahead, plainly shunning her company. In truth, she could understand that, but his broad back, stiffly erect, seemed a rebuke. She began to think on what she might arrange for him that night, with perhaps a touch for the other two as well. For a time, nothing came to mind that could top what she had already done. Then a wasp buzzed past her face, and she watched it fly into the trees alongside the road. Wasps. Of course, she did not want to kill him. "Master Lan, are you allergic to wasp stings?" He twisted in his saddle, half reining his stallion around, and suddenly grunted, his eyes growing wide. For an instant she did not understand. Then she saw the arrowhead sticking out from the front of his right shoulder. Without thought, she embraced the source, and Zaidar filled her. It was as though she were back in the testing again. Her weaves flashed into being. First of all, a clear shield of air to block any more arrows away from Lan, then one for herself. She could not have said why she wove them in that order. With the power in her and her sight sharpened, she scanned the trees where the arrow had come from and caught motion just inside the edge of the forest. Flows of air lashed out to seize the man just as he loosed again, the shaft going up at an angle as his bow was snapped tight against his body. Just heartbeats, that all took, beginning to end, as fast as anything she had woven in testing. Just enough time for two arrows fired by Rhine and Bukama to strike home. With a dismayed groan, she released the bonds of air, and the man toppled backward. He had attempted murder, but she had not intended holding him up as a target for execution. He would have been executed once they had carried him to a magistrate, yet she disliked having been part of carrying out the sentence, especially before it was given. To her mind, it came very near using Zaidar as a weapon, or making a weapon for men to use in killing. Very near. Still holding Zaidar, she turned to Lan to offer healing, but in spite of the arrows sticking from him front and back, he gave her no chance to speak, wheeling his mount and galloping to the edge of the trees, where he dismounted and strode to the fallen man, followed by Bukama and Rhine. With the power in her, she could hear their voices clearly.
"Caniadrin?" Lan said, sounding shocked.
"You know this fellow?" Rhine asked.
"Why?"
Bukama growled, and there came the thud of a boot meeting ribs. A weak voice answered in gasps.
"Gold! Why else? You still have the Dark One's luck, turning just then, or that shaft would have found your heart. He should have told me she's Aes Sedai, instead of just saying to kill her first."
As soon as she heard those words, Warain dug her heels into Arrow's flanks to gallop the short distance and flung herself from the saddle, already preparing the weave for healing. "Get those arrows out of him," she called as she ran toward them, holding up her cloak and skirts to keep from tripping. "If the arrows remain, healing will not keep him alive."
"Why heal him?"
Lan asked, sitting himself down on a storm-fallen tree. Its great spread of dirt-covered roots rose in a fan high above his head.
"Are you so eager to see a hanging?"
"He's dead already," Rhine said. "Can you heal that?" He sounded interested in seeing whether she could. Moiraine's shoulders slumped. Caniadrin's eyes, open and staring up at the branches overhead, were already glazed and empty. Strangely, despite the blood around his mouth, he looked a beardless youth in his rumpled coat. Man enough to do murder, though. Man enough to die with a pair of arrows transfixing his chest. Dead, he could never tell her if it was this Gorthanas who had hired him, or where the man might be found. A nearly full quiver was fastened to his belt, and two arrows stuck upright in the ground nearby. Apparently he had been confident he could kill four people with four shots. Even knowing Lan and Bukama, he had thought so. Knowing them, he had disobeyed his instructions and tried to kill Lan first. The most dangerous of them, as he must have thought. As she studied the man, it came to her that he might tell her a little, even dead. With her belt knife, she sliced away the pouch hanging behind his quiver and emptied the contents beside him amid the small weeds pushing through the mulch. A wooden comb, a half-eaten piece of cheese covered with lint, a small folding knife, a ball of string that she unwound to make sure nothing was hidden inside, a filthy crumpled handkerchief that she unwadded with the tip of her knife blade. It had been too much to hope for a letter written by Master Gorthanas giving instructions on how to find him. Cutting the cords of the leather purse tied to Cunyadrin's belt, she upended that over the litter. A handful of silver and copper spilled out, and 10 gold crowns. So, the price of her death in Kandor was the same as the price of a silk dress in Tarvalin. Fat coins, with the rising sun of Cairhien on one side and her uncle's profile on the other. A fitting footnote in the history of House Domodred. "Have you taken to robbing the dead?" Lan asked in that irritatingly cool voice. "Just asking, not accusing, but still." She straightened angrily just as Rhine snapped off the feathered end of the arrow jutting from Lan's back. Bukama was knotting a narrow strip of rawhide behind the arrowhead. Once he had it tight, he gripped the cord in his fist and gave one quick yank, pulling the arrow the rest of the way through. Lan blinked. The man had an arrow pulled out of his body, and he blinked. Why that should irritate her, she did not know, but it surely did. Rhine hurried back to the road, while Bukama helped Lan off with his coat and shirt, revealing a puckered hole in his front. Likely the one behind was no better. The blood that had been soaking into coat and shirt began to pour freely down his chest and ribs. Neither man asked for healing, and she was of half a mind not to offer it. More scars decorated Lan than she expected on a man so young, and a number of partly healed wounds crossed by neat dark stitches. Seemingly he angered men as easily as he did women. Rhine returned, carrying bandaging cloths and mouthing bread for a poultice. None of them were going to ask for healing until the man bled to death. "Will you accept healing?" she asked coldly, reaching toward Lan's head. He shied back from her touch. He shied back.
"Day after tomorrow in Chachin, you may need your right arm," Bukama muttered,
scrubbing a hand under his nose and not meeting anyone's eyes. A very peculiar thing to say, but she knew there was no point in asking what it meant. After a moment, Lan nodded and leaned forward. That was all. He did not ask or even accept her offer. He just leaned forward. She clapped her hands on his head in something near to a pair of slaps and channeled. The convulsion when the healing weave hit him, arms flinging wide, ripped him out of her grasp. Very satisfying. Even if he did only breathe hard, rather than gasp. His old scars remained. The half-healed wounds were now thin pink lines. The stitches that had been on the outside, now loose, slid down his arms and chest. He might have difficulty picking out the rest, but smooth skin marked where the arrow holes had been. He could meet the wasps in perfect health. She could always heal him again afterward if need be. Only if need be, however. They left the coins lying beside Cunyadrin's body, though the men plainly could have used them. They wanted nothing from the dead man. Bukama found his mount tied a short distance away in the trees, a white-stockinged brown gelding with a look of speed about him and a prancing step. Lan removed the animal's bridle and tied it to the saddle, then slapped the horse's rump and sent him racing toward Ravinda.
"So he can eat until somebody finds him," he explained, when he saw her frowning after the gelding.
In all truth, she had been regretting not searching the saddlebags tied behind the gelding's saddle. But Lan had shown a surprising touch of kindness. She had not expected any such to be found in him. For that, he would escape the wasps. There had to be something memorable in any case. She had only 2 more nights to crack him, after all. Once they reached Chachin, she would be too busy to attend to Lan Mandragoran. For a time, she would be.
Chapter 22. Keeping Custom. If Canlom was a city of hills, Chachin was a city of mountains. The three highest rose almost a mile, even with their peaks sheared off short, and all glittered in the noonday sun with colorful glazed tile roofs and tile-covered palaces. Atop the tallest, the Ace Daishar Palace shone brighter than any other in red and green, the prancing red horse flying above its largest dome. Three towered ring walls surrounded the city, as did a deep dry moat 100 paces wide, spanned by 2 dozen bridges, each with a fortress hulking at its mouth. The traffic was too great here, and the blight too far away, for the helmeted and breastplated guards with the red horse on their chests to be so diligent as in Canlom. But crossing the Bridge of Sunrise, amid tides of wagons and carts and people mounted and afoot, flowing both ways, still took some little while. Once inside the first wall, Lan wasted no time drawing rein, out of the way of the heavy-laden merchants' wagons lumbering past. Even with a Dane waiting, he had never been so glad to see any place in his life. By the letter of the law, they were not truly inside Chachin. The second, higher wall lay more than 100 paces ahead, and the third, still taller, as much beyond that. But he wanted to be done with this Alice. Where in the light had she found fleas this early in the year? And black flies. Black flies should not appear for another month. He was a mass of itching welts. At least she had found no satisfaction in it. Of that he was certain. "The pledge was protection to Chachin, and it has been kept," he told the woman. "So long as you avoid the rougher parts of the city, you are as safe on any street as if you had a bodyguard of 10. So you may see to your affairs, and we will see to ours. Keep your coin," he added coldly when she reached for her purse. Irritation flared for losing self-control. Yet she offered insult atop insult. Rhyn immediately started going on about giving offense to Aes Sedai and offering her smiling apologies and deep bows from his saddle that had his bells ringing like alarm gongs, while Bukama grumbled sourly about men with the manners of pigs, with some justification. Alice herself gazed at him, so near expressionless that she might even have been what she claimed. A dangerous claim, if untrue. And if true, he especially wanted no part of her then. Whirling cat dancer, he galloped up the wide street, scattering people afoot and some mounted. Another time, that might have sparked duels. The Hadore and the reputation that went with it certainly would not have held back anyone but commoners. But he rode too fast to hear a cry of challenge, dodging around sedan chairs and tradesmen's high-wheeled carts and porters carrying loads on their shoulder poles, without slackening his pace. After the quiet of the country, the rumble of iron-rimmed wheels on paving stones and the cries of hawkers and shopkeepers seemed raucous. The flutes of street musicians sounded strident. The smells of roasted nuts and meat pies on vendors' barrows, the smells of cooking in the kitchens of dozens of inns and hundreds of homes, blended into an unpleasant stench after the clean air on the road. 100 stables full of horses added their own flavor. Bukama and Rhyn caught him up with the pack horse before he was halfway up the mountain to the Ace Daishar Palace, and fell into either side. If Idain was in Chachin, she would be there. Wisely, Bukama and Rhyn held their silence. Bukama, at least, knew what he was about to face. Entering the Blight would be much easier. Leaving the Blight alive, at any rate. Any fool could ride into the Blight. Was he a fool to come here? The higher they climbed, the more slowly they moved. There were fewer people in the streets high up, where tile-roofed houses gave way to palaces and the homes of wealthy merchants and bankers, their walls covered with bright tiles, and the street musicians to liveried servants scurrying on errands. Brightly lacquered coaches with house sigils on the doors replaced merchants' wagons and sedan chairs. A coach behind a team of 4 or 6 with plumes on their bridles took up a great deal of room, and most had 6 outriders as well as a pair of backmen, clinging to the rear of the coach, all armed and armored, and ready to dispute with anyone who tried brushing by too closely. In particular, with 3 roughly dressed men who tried. Ryan's yellow coat did not look so fine as it had in Canlewum, and with Lan's second-best coat bloodstained, he was reduced to wearing his 3rd, worn enough to make Bukama seem well-dressed. Thought of the bloodstains brought other thoughts. He owed Alice a debt for her healing, as well as for her torments, though in honor it was only the first he could repay. No, he had to get that odd little woman out of his head, although she seemed to have lodged herself inside his skull somehow. It was Idane he needed to concentrate on. Idane, and the most desperate fight of his life. The Ace Daishar Palace filled the flattened mountaintop completely, an immense shining structure of domes and high balconies covering 50 hides, a small city to itself, every surface shining in patterns of red and green. The great bronze gates, worked with a lacquered red horse, stood invitingly open beneath a red-tiled arch that led to the visitor's yard, but a dozen guards stepped out to bar the way when Lan and the others approached. The red horse was embroidered on the green tabards they wore over their breastplates, and their halberds bore red and green streamers. They were quite colorful, with their red helmets and breeches and their polished high green boots, but any man who served here was a veteran of more than a single battle, and they regarded the three new arrivals through the steel face bars of their helmets with hard eyes. Lan stepped down from the saddle and bowed, not too deeply, touching forehead, heart, and sword hilt. "I am Lan Mandragoran," he said. Nothing more. The guards' stiffness lessened at his name, but they did not give way immediately. A man could claim any name, after all. One of them went running off and returned in moments with a gray-haired officer who carried his red-plumed helmet on his hip. Gerard Shimon was a seasoned campaigner who had ridden with Lan in the south for a time, and his long face broke into a smile.
"Be welcome, Alan Mandragoran," he said, bowing much more deeply than he ever had for Lan on any previous visit. "Taishar Malkir."
Oh yes, if Idane was not here now, she had been. Leading his bay, Lan followed Gerard through the red arch onto the smooth paving stones of the visitor's yard, feeling as though he should have his sword in hand and his armor on. The balconies of stone fretwork that overlooked the broad courtyard took on the aspect of archers' balconies to his eye. Ridiculous, of course. Those open balconies, like lace woven from stone, afforded little protection for archers. They were for watching new arrivals on grand occasions, not defense. No enemy had ever broken past the second ring wall, and should Trollocs ever make it this deep into the city, all was lost. Still, Idane might be here, and he could not shake the feeling of walking onto a battlefield. Grooms in red and green livery with the red horse embroidered on the shoulders came running to take the horses, and more men and women to carry the contents of the pack horses' wicker hampers and show each man to rooms befitting his station. Worryingly, the Shatayan of the palace herself led them. She was a stately, straight-backed woman in livery, graying hair worn in a thick roll on the nape of her neck. The silvered ring of keys at her belt proclaimed that Mistress Romera had charge of all the palace servants, but Shatayan was more than a servant herself. Usually, only crowned rulers could look for a greeting at the gates from the Shatayan. He was swimming in a sea of other people's expectations. Men had drowned in seas like that. He went along to see Bukama's and Rhine's rooms and express his delight in them to Mistress Romera, not because he expected them to be given anything unsuitable, but because it was necessary that he see to his men before himself. Rhine wore a sour expression, but surely he had not expected better than this small room in one of the palace's stone barracks, the same as Bukama. He had known well enough how things would be here. At least Rhine had a room to himself, a bannerman's room, with a tiled stove built in beneath the bed. Ordinary soldiers slept 10 to a room, and, as Lan recalled, spent half their time in winter arguing over who got the beds nearest the fireplace. Bukama settled in happily. Well, happily for him. His scowl very nearly vanished. Talking over pipes of tobacco with a few men he had fought alongside, and Rhine seemed to recover himself quickly. At any rate, by the time Lan was led away, Rhine was asking among the soldiers whether there were any pretty girls among the serving maids and how he could go about getting his clothes cleaned and pressed. He cared almost as much about his appearance, especially in front of women, young or old, as he did about women themselves. Perhaps it had been the thought of appearing in travel-stained garb in front of the Shatayan and the serving women that had soured him. To Lan's great relief, he was not given a visiting king's apartments, despite the Shatayan's escort. His three rooms were spacious, with silk tapestries in the blue walls and a broad cornice worked in stylized mountains rimming the high ceilings, and the substantial furniture was simply carved, with only a little gilding. The bedchamber had a small balcony overlooking one of the palace gardens, and had a bed with a feather mattress wide enough to accommodate four or five. It was all entirely suitable to his station, and he thanked Mistress Romera, perhaps a little more profusely than he should have, because she smiled, her hazel eyes crinkling.
"No one can know what the future may hold, my lord," she said, "but we know who you are."
And then she offered him a small curtsy before leaving. A curtsy? Remarkable. Whatever she said, the Chatillon had her expectations of the future, too. Along with the rooms, he acquired two square-faced serving women, Anya and Esne, who began placing his meager belongings in the wardrobe, and a lanky young fellow named Bulin to run errands, who gaped at Lan's helmet and breast and backplates as he set them on the black lacquered rack beside the door, though he must have seen the like many times here.
"Is Her Majesty in residence?" Lan asked politely.
"No, my lord,"
Anya replied, frowning at his blood-stained coat and setting it aside with a sigh. The gray-haired one of the pair, she might be Esne's mother, he thought. It was not the sight of blood that made her sigh, she would be accustomed to that, but the difficulty of cleaning the coat. With luck, he would receive it back both cleaned and mended. As well as it could be, anyway.
"Queen Atheniella is making a progress through the Heartland."
And Prince Briss? He knew the answer to that. Atheniella and Briss consort could be out of the city at the same time only during wartime. Yet there were forms to be followed. Bulin's jaw dropped open at the suggestion the prince consort might be absent, but an errand boy could not be expected to know all the usages of the court yet. Anya would not have been placed to serve Lan if she were not fully conversant, though.
"Oh, yes, my lord," she said.
Lifting the black-stained shirt, she shook her head before laying the garment aside. Not with the coat. Apparently the shirt was a lost cause. She was shaking her head over most of his garments, even though she put into the wardrobe. Most of them had seen hard use.
"Are any notables visiting?"
He had been itching to ask that as badly as he did from flea and blackfly bites. Anya and Esne exchanged looks.
"Only one of true note, my lord,"
Anya replied. She folded a shirt and laid it in the wardrobe, making him wait.
"The Lady Idaine Errol."
The two women smiled at one another, looking even more alike. Of course, they had known from the start what he was trying to find out, but they had no call to go around grinning over it like idiots. While Bulin gave his boots a much-needed blacking, Lan washed himself from head to toe at the washstand, rather than waiting for a bathtub to be brought, and dabbed an ointment that Anya sent Esne for onto his welts, but he let the women dress him. Just because they were servants was no reason to insult them. He had one white silk shirt that did not show too much wear, a pair of tight black silk breeches that showed almost none, and a good black